All right. Well, good morning, everybody. It's not morning anymore, is it? I think this is the first time I've ever spoken at this noon service, so I'm clearly going to have to be more intentional about what I say when I come up here. Good afternoon, everybody. For those of you that may not know me, because I don't come down here much, clearly, my name is Jason, and I'm a member of our speaking team, and I'm so absolutely thrilled to be with you here this morning. Let me echo what Sandy said and just welcome everyone here, especially if this is your first time with us. We just want to let you know how thrilled we are that you've decided to spend the part of your early afternoon with us here this morning as well. If you're streaming live online right now on live stream, we want to welcome you as well. If you're listening on the podcast, we want to welcome you. I said I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to be here partially because I don't get to come downtown much anymore. So it's cool just to be in this space and to see some faces I haven't seen for a while and catch up. But I'm also excited to be here because what we're going to be talking about this morning, because I believe what we're going to talk about this morning is just eminently relevant. It's so relevant. It's something that I would bet almost every person in here deals with just on a daily basis. And we'll get to that in a moment. I'm excited to be able to have this conversation with you here this morning. We're in the middle of this series called Restoring Relationships, and we're basically looking at a very simple question. We're looking at the question of how can we love well? As we go into the lives of those around us and intentionally try to love them, how can we love well? How can we love them better? And we said early on that there are kind of two things that are required to love well, time and energy, and that both of these things, unfortunately, are in limited supply. We don't have unlimited amounts of time nor energy, and so we have to be intentional about how we deploy those things. And the other thing that we have done throughout the series so far is we kind of set as our backdrop or the context the life of Christ. And we said we're going to look at the life of Christ and realize that he was also limited in time and energy. So how did he do this? As he went into the lives of people around him and tried to love them well, how did he manage the fact that he was restricted in his time and energy? How did he do that? And I hope it's going well for you guys. I hope you chose a person. That was the other thing we said is let's all of us pick one person just so we have a really specific test case as we go through this. So I hope it's going well as you've tried to move into that person's life and be intentional. But if it hasn't, that's okay. That's okay. We'll keep working at it. And I'll remind you, I'll bring you up to speed. As a matter of fact, if you need to start over this week, fine. We started it in week one and we talked about the principle of rest and the idea that rest isn't something to be overcome, but rather something to be embraced. That we looked at the fact that God created us to need rest. This is a part of who we are and how we're made. And so we need to start looking at rest as a way to invest in our ability to love well. And then last week, we looked at the principle of intentionality and recognized the fact that the reality is love does not happen automatically. Love doesn't happen just on accident. And if we're going to love well, we have to be intentional about how we're deploying these limited resources of time and energy to love better and better. So again, I hope it's going well, but if it hasn't, don't be discouraged. This is a journey we're on. This is not a point in time. Set new goals and just get cranking as you go out of here today. But the reality is, as you think through this, even when we show up into the lives of our friends, and we show up and we're there and we're rested, sometimes it's still not easy to love well. Sometimes there are still obstacles. And as a matter of fact, there's one specific problem that I think is an obstacle to loving well. And I think this problem is becoming more and more pervasive in our society today. And it looks something like this. You guys may have actually seen that video before. As of this morning, there were like almost 25 million views of that video on YouTube. And ironically enough, I bet most of those views probably came on a cell phone. It's unbelievable the change that this technology has brought into our life. These little things have done something that's subtle, but I think it's huge. These little things have given us the idea that we can be omnipresent. They've given us the idea that we can be in multiple places at the same time. So no longer do we have to feel confined by these old-fashioned, archaic rules of time and space. I can actually be in more places than once. I can be both here and there. I can be here and completely somewhere else. So you can be at dinner with your friends physically, but you can also be out there completely interacting with people on Twitter. I can be at home with my wife, but virtually still at work and just firing off work emails on my phone or my iPad. You can be at your son's baseball game and also at the Yankees game, completely trying to be in two places at once. And on the surface, this may seem like a good thing. You think, well, yeah, this is multitasking. This is just making me more efficient. But I think if we're not careful, we'll find that these distractions can destroy our ability to love well. Because the reality is, you can't love well if you're not there. And I don't mean just physically there. I mean really there. There with your whole being. If your head and your heart aren't in the same place as your feet, I would challenge you that you're going to be so distracted, you are not going to be able to love well. And don't get me wrong, this is not an issue that's confined just to smartphones. There may be some of you here this morning that still have a flip phone, and so you don't even have the ability to go on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. You can still come home from work and find yourself physically with your family, but mentally you're still at work, or you're just a million miles away. You're still distracted. This is also not a new phenomenon that's just been brought on by technology. I think sometimes we have the idea that our modern world is so sophisticated, that the problems we face today, the problems we face with all this technology today are so new because we're so sophisticated that we're facing problems that other generations have never, ever faced. And that's not true either. This problem of distraction has been around, I would dare say, as long as people have been around. There's actually a story in the life of Jesus where this idea is laid out really clearly, and I want to take you there this morning. It's found in the book of Luke in the 10th chapter, and I'm going to start reading in verse 38 of Luke chapter 10. As Jesus and the disciples continued on their way to Jerusalem, they came to a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Now, I'm going to set the scene a little bit because I think it helps understand the impact of the story here. Jesus and his disciples are on the road. They're on the way to Jerusalem, and they come to this village, and we're not really sure how it comes about, but somehow they get invited into the home of this woman that we don't know much about otherwise, named Martha, for dinner. It also helps to understand a little bit about where Jesus' ministry is in terms of kind of the life cycle of his life and his ministry. When we read this story in the book of Luke, Jesus is not some young, new startup preacher from Galilee that no one's ever heard of. When you get to this point and we read about this story, Jesus has already been on the scene for a while. He's already been doing a lot of miracles. He's already fed the 5,000. You may be familiar with that story. That's already happened. He's actually raised someone from the dead at this point. We read up to this point, Jesus has already gotten to the point where when he and his disciples show up in a village, they're just mobbed by throngs and throngs of people and crowds. People know who Jesus is at this point. They know that he's the Messiah that the nation of Israel has been waiting for thousands and thousands of years. For lack of a better word, Jesus is a rock star at this point in the story. And so we find him showing up in this village, and he gets invited into the home of this woman named Martha. Put yourself in her shoes, and you guys may have played this game before in your life where you're with a group of friends and you just ask each other the question, hey, if you could have dinner with one person in the world, who would it be? Anybody. If you could have someone tonight come over. So I want you to think through that question. Maybe your answer is Jesus, and so for you it's going to be kind of easy to put yourself in Martha's shoes. But maybe it's not. Maybe there's someone else, and I'm not even going to try to guess, but think, who could you have, or who would you choose if you could have anyone over for dinner tonight? That's essentially what happened to Martha. She had Jesus, the Messiah that her people had been waiting on for thousands of years, come into her home for dinner. And that's where we pick up the story as we continue reading. Her sister Mary, this is Martha's sister, her sister Mary sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing. She came to Jesus and said, Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me. Sounds understandable, right? Well, what we see playing out is that as the night goes on, Mary is actually just sitting at the feet of Jesus, being fully present. She's absolutely there, just soaking in this opportunity to sit at the foot of Jesus. And Martha, on the other hand, is just running around, distracted by all these things that undoubtedly needed doing, but she was distracted and she wasn't there in the moment for this opportunity. And listen to what Jesus says to her. But the Lord said to her, "My dear Martha, you're worried and upset over all these details. There is only one thing worth being concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and it will not be taken away from her." Mary was there. Martha wasn't. Martha's head and her heart weren't where her feet were. Mary understood well this principle that to love well, and then the reverse, to be loved well, you have to be present. And the message that Jesus gave to Martha was, these things can wait, Martha. These things can wait. Be here with me. Be present. Be in the moment. It's the same message that comes to us today as we face into all these distractions. Jesus says to us, just be here. All of these other things can wait. Your work email, that can wait. The posts that you're wanting to get up on Facebook, that can wait. The photos that you're wanting to upload to Instagram, those can wait. The dishes, they can wait. Your fantasy football updates, those can wait. And I know the guys are going, oh, no, they can't wait. Actually, they can't. It's past 12 now, so if you haven't done that, it really can wait until next week. Candy Crush can wait. So also, for all you guys out there, Candy Crush can wait. So you guys thought I was going to be sexist there and go to the girls with Candy Crush. That's not true, because I actually have a confession to make. I am addicted to Candy Crush. I don't have a fantasy football team, yet I'm addicted to Candy Crush. It's embarrassing. Those things can wait. That's the message. If we're going to love well, as we go into the lives of those around us and try to be intentional, not only about how we spend our time and making sure we're rested so we're energetic, we also need to be intentional to make sure that our head and our hearts are always in the same place that our feet are. Our heads and our hearts have to be in the same place that our feet are if we're going to be fully there and have the ability to love well. I think there are probably a ton of different things that contribute to this phenomenon that we talked about, this desire to kind of want to be in multiple places and to be distracted and want to be always doing multiple things at once. There are probably a ton of things that drive this type of behavior, and I would imagine for years to come, sociologists and psychologists will be doing research and writing papers and putting forth theories on kind of what's going on right now in this crazy time in history where we've just been bombarded with a sea change in the way that we interact with information and can interact with people around us. But I want to talk about one thing this morning that I think is extremely crucial. And I think this thing is crucial because the reality is what we're going to talk about now is a false god. I believe it's an idol. And it's not an obvious idol either. It's very subtle. And if we're not careful, we'll find ourselves worshiping this false god. And it's this, the false god of wanting to be envied. The idol of being envied. Notice that I didn't say envy. I think that's clearly a danger. I think that's clearly a sin. And that's actually an obvious one, right? I mean, if you know anything about the Ten Commandments, you'll know that that's the Ten Commandments. One of them has to do with that. Don't covet what's not yours. Don't be envious of what other people have. That's an obvious one. I think the other side of that coin is one that can potentially be just as dangerous, and it's really, really subtle. Because there's a danger that we find ourselves wanting to create a life, or at least the perception of a life, so that other people will want to be like us. So that other people will look at us and they'll envy the life that we have. And this is an area, this is an attitude, this is a false god that I think technology generally and social media specifically, I think enables this. Because if you think about what social media has allowed us to do, we have the ability now to completely manufacture any image that we want for ourselves. We have the ability to create this image and then project out this image to those around us and be very careful about the image that we're creating and projecting. And every good marketing company knows this. And if you work in a company that does marketing and sales, you know this well. Marketing companies know how to create a brand and then meticulously manage that brand and very, very carefully project out what they want people to know about that brand and only allow things to get out that are consistent with what they want that brand to stand for and to suppress any other information that might be contradictory to what they want that brand to mean. And marketing companies have been doing this for years and years and years, and all of a sudden in the past few years, we had the ability to do that with ourselves. We essentially had the ability, each of us, to become our own mini PR firm. We can create any brand that we want and then really carefully manage that brand and only project out the things that we want people to know. What life do I want people to think that I lead? Now, let me say something here, and I want to be really clear and upfront about this, a bit of a disclaimer. This is not a bash Facebook message, and I want to be absolutely clear about that. In my mind, it's my opinion, and I would guess most of you probably agree with this. Maybe not everyone, but most of you probably do. My opinion is that Facebook specifically and social media more generally and technology and the internet even more generally, the benefits of those things are so obvious. The things that the opportunities they've brought into our life are so obvious as to be nearly self-evident. And so I don't even think that's a discussion that we need to have. And so I'm not trying to have a debate this morning about is Facebook good or bad? Is social media good or bad? To me, the things they brought into our life are obvious. And you, I don't have to repeat them. You know them all. The ability to just engage and stay connected with family and friends and loved ones that may live thousands of miles away is just phenomenal to be able to do that. The spread of God's word. I mean, think about what technology has done for God's kingdom. As it's just allowed literally everybody can be carrying a Bible around in their hand in whatever language you name it, whatever version of the Bible they want. It's the benefits of it are obvious, I think. And so it's not my intention to get up here and say Facebook's bad. I think it can be phenomenal. But what I do think is really valuable, and that's what I want us to engage in this morning, is a very honest and transparent and introspective conversation about the underlying motivation that drives us to interact with Facebook and social media in the way that we do. What's the underlying motivating factors that cause us to interact with the virtual world in the ways that we do? I think that's an extremely, extremely valuable discussion. And I mentioned introspective. I think it's one that you may start processing that today, and you may have, in fact, kind of recoiled with a defensive posture and said, don't judge me. Like, you don't know what my motivations are. And you're absolutely right, I don't. So let me make this point. This is not a discussion that I'm having to you. This is a discussion that I'm having with you together. This is something I'm wrestling with myself and just trying to be really honest in evaluating, what are the motivations for how I engage with all the technology that I now have at my fingertip? And is it possible that even in some small way, I'm allowing this false god of wanting to be envied to seep into the way I interact with these technologies? And so am I checking my messages every 5 minutes because I'm really that busy, or am I doing it because I want people to see how important I am? Oh, look at me. Yeah, I'm getting, everybody is sending me stuff. I'm so important. Am I engaging with social media? Am I putting things out there to stay connected to my family and my friends that don't live close by and wouldn't otherwise get to kind of see what I do? Or am I doing it to try to project an image? Am I consciously thinking, oh, look how witty my tweets are. Look how cool my photos are. Look how exotic the vacations I take are. Look at this amazing restaurant that I can afford to go to. what's the underlying motivation for how we interact with these technological platforms that are amazing, but can also be dangerous and destructive if we're not careful and we don't think about it. And I would argue that even in some small measure, if that has become our motivation, if the desire to create an image, to create a life, or at least the perception of a life that other people would look at and want and be envied, I would argue that we're worshiping a false god of wanting to be envied. And I would also argue that if that's true, if we're doing that, if that's driving us, even in some small part, then we'll never be content to just be where we are. To just be in one place, fully there. Because, you see, when you're constantly feeling driven to do more and to just project this image and to keep up with everyone around you, then you're just constantly, constantly going to be trying to be in more places at once, to be doing more and more things, to be impressing more and more people. It'll be impossible to keep your head and your heart in the same place that your feet are. As I was thinking through this past week, my introspection started about a week ago, so I'm a little ahead of you guys, and it's been an interesting journey. As I was thinking through this, and I was trying to think, what are the underlying kind of drivers of this desire that we sometimes can have to want to kind of create this life or a perception of a life? And normally where there are problems, it's not the thing that's the problem, it's the thing under the thing, right? It's the thing that's kind of, what's the underlying root cause of really what's driving this behavior? And as I kind of peeled back layers and really thought about it, I think one of the things that's at the very core of this issue as we struggle with it is fear. Fear that leads to insecurity and discontentment, ultimately. And so, again, am I checking my messages every 5 minutes because I'm really that busy? Or am I doing that because I've decided that in my life, my work, and running the rat race and just being caught up in this culture that's so easy to get caught up in this part of the country specifically, is that where I derive my value from? From the fact that I've got this job and I'm constantly on the go. And so I live constantly in fear. I live in fear that if I take one step back, if I slow down just for a minute, if I step off of the hamster wheel, just for a moment, I'm going to lose ground. And if I do that, this whole thing could just start to crumble and I could lose my identity because that's where I find it. Fear and insecurity would then be driving that behavior. Am I putting things out there on social media because I want to just stay connected and just let my family and friends see what I'm up to and just love them and let them love me through being involved in my life? Or am I purposefully trying to craft an image and a life because deep down, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that if my life isn't seen to be as put together or as fabulous as everyone else's, that I might be missing out. You guys heard the acronym FOMO? I thought about saying this. I've got to be careful how I say that. FOMO. So it's, if you haven't heard it, fear of missing out. Fear of missing out. And it's basically, it's the idea that as we kind of engage with those around us, and usually on social media, but it doesn't always have to be, as we look at what's going on around us, FOMO is this anxiety that just starts to well up within us as we look around and we start to fear that we're missing out. We look at the lives of everyone going on around us and what they're doing, and we get anxious and we start to fear that our life isn't as put together as their life is, as our life might not be as fabulous as theirs is. And so sometimes I think we kind of strategically deploy this preemptive reverse FOMO strategy. And so we go, you know what? I'm not going to wait till I go on Facebook and get depressed because everybody seems to be doing all these fabulous things and I'm not. I'm going to go preemptively just load up and I'm going to create this image and put everything out there and say, look at me and look at the things that I'm doing. Don't you wish that you were like me? And that's a dangerous place to be, because when you're doing that when and that's driving you, as I said, we will never be comfortable just being there, because we're always just going and we're driven by fear and insecurity. And the good news, as I thought through this, and I said, that's kind of a scary place to be if that's true. But the good news is, I can't think of a message that you read about more consistently and more frequently throughout God's Word. And I mean from start to finish. I can't think of a message that you get more consistently and frequently than this. Do not fear. Our God calls us to fear not over and over again. We don't worship a God that calls us into a life of fear and insecurity and discontentment. As I was thinking through this, I actually did a little exercise. I went to God's Word, and I just pulled out literally every reference, every time from Genesis all the way through to Revelation in the New Testament that God mentioned, do not fear or fear not. And this is what I came up with. So if you've got your Bibles with you, if you would get them out, we're going to go through these one by one. I did this in the earlier service. It only took about an hour and 20 minutes. And so I'd get you guys out of here by like 2 o'clock. We'll be fine. I'm joking. We're not going to go through these. I see some of you guys writing. I didn't put this up here for you to write these passages. If you really want these passages, email us and I can email you out this slide. I put this up here and made it kind of purposefully non-readable just because I wanted you guys to get the magnitude of this message. I mean, you look at that and you realize, wow, that must be a serious message that God has for his people. Fear not. Our God does not want us to live a life of fear and insecurity and discontentment. And almost as often as you read this message of fear not, you see a companion message that usually goes along with it. And it has to do with God telling us how valuable that we are. He says, don't fear and don't be insecure because you have more value than you will ever realize. And the amazing thing about this value that God tells us that we have is God values us not based on all the cool things that we've done. We derive our value from God not based on some level of status that we've achieved. We get our value from God not based on the number of Instagram followers we have. We get our value from God, and he tells us this over and over again, you are valuable precisely because you are created in my image. I created you, he says, and I created you in my image. Don't you think you're valuable just because of that? You don't need to constantly be chasing this image and trying to put out a perception of a life that's fabulous. God tells you, you are valuable because you're made in my image. And he also says, you're valuable for another huge reason. Jesus Christ came to this earth and he lived in a body just like we have. And he walked just like we do. And he experienced temptations and all the things that we do. But he did something that we could never do. He faced into all of those temptations and he defeated every single one of them. He lived a perfect life and he fulfilled the law for us, which is something we could never, ever do. And then ultimately he went to the cross and he died for us. And when he did that, he took everything that was broken about us. He took everything that was ugly about us. All these things that had we still had them, all these things that would lead to fear and discontentment and insecurity, he took those things and he said, here, give them to me. I know you don't deserve it. That's not the point. Give them to me, all of them. And he took all of those things that are broken, and he just put them on his shoulders. And he just absorbed them all for us. And in exchange for that, he gave us his perfection. And so when God looks down on you right now, he doesn't need to log on to your Facebook page to see how fabulous you are. God looks at you right now, and he says, you have so much more value than you will ever know just because of who you are. Just because you're made in my image. And because I've given you the righteousness of my perfect Son. You have it. We are valuable, not based on what we've done or a false life that we try to project. We're valuable based on a God that created us in his image. And when we truly start to understand this, when you start to grasp this truth, and we really start to grasp the enormity of what happened on that cross, when we truly start to know in our heart where our value really comes from, then everything changes. I mean, everything changes. So all of a sudden, we're comfortable to just be where we are because we know where we get our value from. And we don't feel the need to constantly be promoting ourselves and building up an image about ourselves and trying to impress other people. We learn to just be right where God placed us, to be with who God placed us, and just enjoy his blessings. And when we get to that place of just understanding where our value comes from, something else happens. All of a sudden, you're just overwhelmed with this idea of gratitude. Because you understand how much you didn't deserve it, how much you didn't do anything to earn it, yet you know God actually just gave it to you freely, and when he looks at you, he just sees perfection. And the only reaction you can have is to fall on your knees in gratitude. And it's this that I think is the key to destroying this false idol, gratitude. If we can get to this place where we're so confident and comfortable in the value that we have, that we can just spend our time thanking God for where we are and what we have, how little or how much that is, then that destroys this false idol of wanting to be envied. All that stuff just goes away, and we forget about the image of us that's projected out, and we rest confidently in the image that he has given us. Gratitude. And the Apostle Paul understood this really well. He writes a letter to a group of Christians in the town of Colossae, and we can read where Paul talks about this idea of gratitude, and I want to read that quickly. In Colossians 3, verses 16 and 17, let the message about Christ and all its richness fill your lives. Teach and counsel each other with all the wisdom he gives. Sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs to God with thankful hearts. And whatever you do or say, do it as a representative of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father. What a beautifully simple message, right? The Apostle Paul says here, let the message of Christ be what fills you up. Let the message of Christ be where you derive your value from. And just learn to enjoy where God has placed you. Just learn to enjoy and be thankful for what you have from the Father. Now, while I said it's a beautifully simple message, it's not necessarily an easy message to follow or to internalize, I don't think. Because the reality is, when you guys go out of here in about 10 or 15 minutes, you're still going to take these smartphones with you, and we're still going to have Facebook, and you still have demands of work and the constant emails that are coming in, and we still have all these distractions that we have to figure out a way to deal with. And so that's what I want us to talk a little bit about now, is just some really practical things that we can do as we go out and we try to intentionally love well, and we try to intentionally keep our head and our hearts in the same place that our feet are this week so that we're there. I want to talk about some practical things we can do to make sure that the distractions that sometimes we so easily succumb to, that we can figure out a way to kind of rein those things in. And all the practical things I talk about all kind of fall under one general principle, and it's this. Let's be intentional about making technology a tool that we use instead of a tool that uses us. Make technology a tool that you use instead of a tool that uses you. And just as it is with any other tool, we all probably have tools, at least some tools in our places, right? A hammer, a screwdriver. And just as with any other tool, this technology has a wonderful role to play in our life, but it also has very specific time and place where it is to be used. And I think that's the switch that we need to turn on, is being intentional about making sure that technology is just a tool that we use And it doesn't become something that just envelops us and becomes something that uses us. And so let me throw out a few really practical things that'll help hopefully start to allow us to conquer this. And the first one is this. If you don't need it, don't bring it. If you don't need it, don't bring it. I know it seems obvious. This one's hard for me because I don't know about you, but I mean, my iPhone is like, it's like my car keys and my wallet. It's just something I pick wherever I go. It doesn't matter. I just pick it up and I take it with me without even thinking. I don't even have to be leaving the house. Like, I'll be going like to the shower and I just take it in there and I'm thinking, what do you do? Like, why do you need this? It's just become an appendage that we take with us everywhere. What if we start being more thoughtful about where we're going, who we're going to be with, and how we're going to be interacting, and just ask ourselves a question, do I need this? You know, if I'm at home with my wife and we decide to go down for 30 minutes to the local pizzeria on the corner and have a bite to eat for dinner, what, we don't have kids, so there's going to be no emergency phone calls from the babysitter. What, we're both there, so who else? Are the two most important people in each of our lives are there at the same table. Why? If we bring our phones, which we usually do, what we end up doing is talking to each other half the time, and then my wife ends up taking pictures of the pizza and putting it on Instagram. And then while she's doing that, I'm bored, and so I go, well, fine, I'll do something too, and it's just ridiculous. If you don't need it, don't bring it. But the reality is we're still going to bring these things with us a lot of places. So I want to give you some other guidelines and guardrails that we can put in place as we take those things. And just a few of these things are, another one is turn down the notifications. Just turn off the notifications. Do you really need to be like beeped and buzzed and prodded and vibrated every time someone likes one of your pictures on Facebook or every time you get a new message on whatever? If we're going to have our phones with us, turn down the notifications so that we're at least minimizing the risk or the distraction or the temptation to reach in our pocket because we feel it just buzzing constantly. Another one is, put the other one up because I forgot the order of these. The other one is set a time limit. And if there are any parents in the group, I guarantee you understand this principle well because I think most parents face this issue with kids today, right? And so I would bet most parents set time limits for their kids. Hey, you have 30 minutes a night to be on the iPad. We get that. What if that's not a principle that's only good for kids? What if that's something that might be good for adults too? To say, you know what? I'm not just going to live on this thing. I'm going to take 10 minutes a day, and that's my time to go on and check what's going on Facebook, upload, make a status, let my family know what I'm doing, whatever. Set time limits. Put the next one up. Schedule. I'm going to remember the order on one of these. Schedule time for distractions. I think this is something else that is key. The reality is these things aren't going away, right? No one's going to honestly say, I shouldn't say no one, maybe you will. But most of us probably aren't going to stop checking Facebook or getting on Twitter. I mean, these things do play an important role, but just schedule time for distractions. Say, you know what, when I'm at work and I go to lunch, I'm going to take 10 minutes of my lunch break and I'm going to go and just do all my updates there. And I'm not going to be just drug into this constant need every 20 minutes to go and see what's going on. Set a time for distractions. Set zones in your life. I love this one as well. Set zones in your life that are like technology-free zones. And to me, the most obvious one, because it's probably the most destructive place that bringing technology into creates, is the dinner table. What if we all just said, the dinner table is a phone-free zone? Whether you're at home with your family or whether you're out at a restaurant with your wife or your girlfriend or boyfriend or your family, just say no. No phones at the dinner table. Whatever you do, though, and you may think some of these are good ideas, you may not like them, you probably have a lot of other ideas on your own. Whatever you end up doing, the important thing, I think, is to be intentional about it and to create a plan. Just create a plan for how you're going to interact with technology and be intentional about making sure it's a tool that you use and not a tool that uses you. And there may be some of you here today that read this and you're like, man, you don't know how deep I am. I'm like deep and these little like half measures aren't going to cut it. And if that's you right now, you probably need to go deeper than this. And so I would challenge you, just stop. Start over. Take the iPhone and put it away for 40 days. Swallow your pride and go get a flip phone from the Verizon store. They're really cheap these days. So just cut the cord if that's where you think you are. And I know that sounds drastic, but that may be where you are. You need to just stop and just get that toxic addiction out of your system if you feel like that's where you are. And then use that time to build a plan, put together a plan, and then come back online 40 days later, hopefully with some intentionality and ready to hit the road and love the people. And I know we laugh and it is kind of funny, but when you really think about it, it's not always funny. Because, guys, what we're doing here, the mission that we're on, it's way, way too important to go through it and to tackle it half-heartedly, distracted, only with half of our being invested in it. This mission that we're on to love people, it's way, way too important. And isn't that what this is all about, is loving people? We talk about that all the time, that everything that we do here is about that. It's about realizing what God did for us and then being thankful and just radiating that love out to those around us so that the people that we come in contact with see and they're drawn to this God. It's a mission that we're on, and loving people is a part of that mission, and it's way, way too important for us to go through it distracted, not loving well, because our head and our hearts are consistently in different places than we find our feet. As we go into this week, let's be intentional, not just about setting aside time for those that we love, not only resting up so that we can enter into that time energetic and ready to go, let's also be intentional about making sure our head and our hearts are consistently in the same place that our feet are. So as we step into the lives of people that we're trying to love, we're loving them with the fullness of everything we have. They deserve it. God deserves it. Will you pray with me? Father, we come to you this afternoon more than anything with just hearts full of gratitude. And we know we always don't have that same heart of gratitude, because the reality is we go through our weeks and so often we just get distracted. And there are so many things that just pull our attention in just 100 different ways. And so we find ourselves physically with people that we're trying to love, but we're not there. And this morning, as we think through this and talk through this, we're just reminded that if we want to really love people well, we can't do that. That if we want to reflect out to people around us the same love that you have given to us, it deserves our all. It deserves everything that we have. And so this morning, we have hearts of gratitude because we realize just what it is you've done for us. We realize just where it is that we derive our value from, and that our value doesn't come from anything that we do. And so we know we can just give up this mission that some of us struggle with, of trying to constantly prove ourselves and just create a life that other people will want to live. And we can just enjoy the life that you've given us, because that's enough. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for loving us unconditionally. Thank you for your Son. It's in His name that we pray. Amen.